Club History, the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 44, Perambulating the Bounds. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to take a look at one of the oldest laws that's still on the books in Massachusetts. Since the 1650s, towns in our Commonwealth have had a responsibility to mark and measure their boundaries every few years. Despite advances in technology, this practice meant that someone had to go out and perambulate the bounds of the city, or walk the town lines, for about 330 years. Does that sound like fun? I think it's been a pretty good time for many generations of selectmen and city councilors. But before we find out about perambulating the bounds, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is September 4th. On September 4th, 1841, John Quincy Adams addressed the House of Representatives in an attempt to avoid war with England. 4 years earlier, the sheriff of Niagara, Ontario, Alexander MacLeod, had taken part in the Caroline Affair. The Caroline Affair was part of a rebellion in Upper Canada in which British forces attacked Canadian rebels aboard an American steamer. An American crewman was killed, and the steamer was burned. MacLeod bragged about his part in the attack, and the U.S. arrested him and charged him with murder. The tension brought the U.S. and Britain to the brink of war, and former Secretary of State and President John Quincy Adams was trying to prevent it. Is it for a Christian nation, in cold blood, 4 years after a defensive irregularity of border war, provoked by their own people, to hold a man responsible to their municipal law for murder, because the life of a man was lost in a nocturnal foray authorized by the public authorities, civil and military, of the country in whose defense it was undertaken and achieved? Sir, there is not a civilized country upon the earth but would cry shame on us for carrying such barbarian principles into practice. A war provoked by such an act would be a war of extermination, a war of merciless butchery, and the scene of its first unutterable sufferings would be the very border of our own country, upon which we should bring down this judgment of heaven. You may have noticed this in history class, but the United States did not fight a war against British Canada in 1841. Thanks, John Q.
In the exciting early days of aviation, four open cockpit biplanes took off from Seattle in April 1924. They flew northwest to Alaska, where the lead plane crashed into a mountain near Dutch Harbor barely a week into the journey. After being lost in a storm for a few days, the pilot and co-pilot hiked 10 days out of the mountains to the sea and safety, but they were unable to rejoin the flight. The other three planes, the New Orleans, the Chicago, and the Boston, continued west. Their goal was to become the first people to circumnavigate the globe by air. They flew from the Aleutian Islands for Japan, but diverted to a remote Soviet island. They made the first successful trans-Pacific flight, but also made a bit of a diplomatic mess, as the Soviets had not approved the landing or the arrival of the U.S. Navy ship that met them there. Then they proceeded onward to Japan, to Shanghai, and to what was then called Indochina, today's Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. There, the Chicago made an emergency landing in the jungle, and the pilots negotiated their way out using broken doughboy French, a $50 bill, and American cigarettes. Within days, repairs were made, and the crew pressed on to Calcutta. From there, they hopscotched to Karachi, Baghdad, Constantinople, and onward to Paris, where they arrived in time to enjoy Bastille Day and the Olympic Games. The crew were veteran combat pilots from the French front in World War I, and they were given a hero's welcome. After Bastille Day, they received word that other nations had flights in progress that rivaled their own bid to be the first around the world. So they pressed onward. They flew across the channel to Britain, then toward Iceland. Two planes made it safely, but the Boston crashed in the icy North Atlantic. A U.S. Navy destroyer was able to safely rescue the crew, but the aircraft was a total loss. The New Orleans and the Chicago pressed on to Greenland, and then to Labrador. During that last crossing, the Chicago lost its oil pump, and the co-pilot had to manually pump oil through the engine for 4 hours. After they landed, he told the press, "I pumped until I thought I couldn't pump anymore. Then I'd look down at that cold water and start all over again." After they landed, they were also met by a replacement plane, the Boston 2. Finally, they arrived back on American soil, landing in Boston on September 5th, 1924. You may think you take some long flights, but these guys have been flying for 5 months at that point, and it would take them 23 more days to make it back to Seattle and complete the circumnavigation. In Boston, they were met on East Boston's tiny airfield by the governor, paraded through the streets, and praised by dignitaries in speeches given on the steps of the state at his house. It was a far cry from the icy waters of the Bering Sea or the humid jungle of Indochina.
Wednesday is September 6th. A lot of people were surprised that the sky over Boston didn't darken significantly during last month's partial solar eclipse. While people along the path of totality experienced darkness at noon, the sun is so powerful that as long as any of it is visible, the dimming of the eclipse was negligible. However, on September 6th, 1881, Bostonians experienced twilight during the daytime, and it had nothing to do with an eclipse at all. That morning, a yellow mist that they referred to as a London fog began enveloping Boston. As the mist thickened, some people remembered the old adage that a yellow sky presaged a storm and worried that a hurricane was coming.
In the eye of a hurricane, there is quiet for just a moment. A yellow sky.
A few people worried that the world might be coming to an end as they remembered the prophecy attributed to 16th century soothsayer Mother Shipton that said, "The world to an end shall come in 1881. However, that prophecy had been invented for an 1862 book attributed to her, but wasn't something she ever said. By noon, the birds were roosting for the night, and mills and factories that relied on natural light for their production floors were forced to close. Trains left South Station with their lamps lit, which was usually reserved for evening and overnight trains. Gas lamps were lit throughout the city, but they cast an unnaturally bright, white light through the yellow fog, rather than their usual warm glow. The next day's Boston Globe described how the yellow sky played tricks with nature's colors. Flowers of pink turned pure white, and the serene blue of the lobelia became a deep bronze, while flowers of yellow became pearly in their whiteness. Fine, peach-hued geraniums turned to glaring light, and the cardinal columns became of an unnatural lavender. The grass became a wonderful blue in many places, and the trees varied in their colors from deep-sea green to Prussian blue. Though there was no smell of smoke on the breeze, the yellow day was a result of fire. In faraway Michigan, a forest fire known as the Thumb Fire had swept across four counties and burned over 1 million acres. A huge column of smoke was carried high into the atmosphere, where it mixed with the clouds as it was carried east toward Boston. By evening, the skies were beginning to clear, and after dark, the stars were visible.
By late 1783, John and Abigail Adams had been on opposite sides of the Atlantic for over 3 years. John wrote home from Paris on September 7th. "In these circumstances, I must stay another winter. I cannot justify going home. But what shall I do for want of my family? Will you come to me this fall and go home with me in the spring? You may embark for London, Amsterdam, or any port of France. On your arrival, you'll find friends enough. The moment I hear of it, I will fly with post horses to receive you at least, and if the balloon should be carried to such perfection in the meantime as to give mankind the safe navigation of the air, I will fly in one of them at the rate of 30 knots an hour. This is my sincere wish. Although the expense will be considerable, the trouble to you great, and you will probably have to return with me in the spring, I am so unhappy without you that I wish you would come at all events. I am determined to be with you in America, or have you with me in Europe, as soon as it can be accomplished consistent with private prudence and the public good." I especially love the reference to flying to meet Abigail in a balloon. The Montgolfier brothers had demonstrated the first ever hot air balloons earlier that summer. The first successful human balloon ascents were made in the fall of 1783, so it might have been somewhat premature to think that they'd be a reliable means of transportation before Abigail arrived. Despite John's impatience, Abigail Adams would not arrive in Europe until August of 1784, after they had been separated for almost 4.5 years.
Friday is September 8th. After arriving in Cambridge in July of 1775 and taking over command of the Patriot Army that surrounded occupied Boston, George Washington was eager for a victory. Much of his time in the first few months was taken up in reorganizing the army, arranging logistics, and carrying out courts-martial. Finally, on September 8, 1775, he gathered his generals for a conference, saying he wanted to know whether, in your judgments, we cannot make a successful attack upon the troops in Boston by means of boats, co-operated by an attempt upon their lines at Roxbury. The success of such an enterprise depends, I well know, upon the all-wise disposer of events, and is not within the reach of human wisdom to foretell the issue. But if the prospect is fair, the undertaking is justifiable, under the following among other reasons which may be assigned. The season is now fast approaching when warm and comfortable barracks must be erected for the security of the troops against the inclemency of winter. Large and costly provisions must be made in the article of wood for the supply of the army, and, after all that can be done in this way, it is but too probable that fences, woods, orchards, and even houses themselves will fall a sacrifice to the want of fuel before the end of winter. A very considerable difficulty, if not expense, must accrue on account of clothing for the men now engaged in the service, and if they do not enlist again, this difficulty will be increased to an almost insurmountable degree. Blankets, I am informed, are now much wanted, and not to be got. How, then, shall we be able to keep soldiers to their duty, already impatient to go home, when they come to feel the severity of winter without proper covering? If this army should not incline to engage for a longer time than the 1st of January, what consequences can more certainly follow than that you must either be obliged to levy new troops, and thereby have two sets, or partly so, in pay at the same time, or by disbanding one before you set to get the other, expose the country to desolation, and the cause perhaps to irretrievable ruin? These things are not unknown to the enemy. Perhaps it is the very ground they are building on. If they are not waiting for a large reinforcement, and if they are waiting for succors, ought it not to give a spur to the attempt? These, upon many other reasons which might be assigned, induce me to wish a speedy finish of the dispute. But to avoid these evils, we are not to lose sight of the difficulties, the hazard, and the loss that may accompany the attempt, nor what will be the probable consequences of a failure. Luckily, the generals were able to talk Washington out of attempting an all-out assault against the fortified town of Boston. His army was undertrained and under-equipped, and though the British regulars had suffered severe losses during the march on Concord and the Battle of Bunker Hill, they were still one of the best fighting forces in the world, defending an entrenched position. 3 days later, the Council of War concluded. On the other hand, the hazard, the loss of men in the attempt, and the probable consequences of failure are to be considered. After duly weighing the above proposition, considering the state of the enemy's lines, and the expectation of soon receiving some important advices from England, it was unanimously agreed that it was not expedient to make an attempt at present, at least. Late in the winter of 1775 to 1776, Washington would again convene his generals. This time, he argued in favor of an assault on Boston across the ice from Roxbury. Again, the generals were able to talk him down. Finally, his strategy of emplacing the cannons stolen from Fort Ticonderoga on Dorchester Heights was successful, driving the British from Boston in March of 1776.
The Mark II was an early electromechanical computer, the kind that was as big as a small house and read its programs off a long paper tape. It had been financed by the U.S. Navy and designed and built at Harvard University. Before being delivered to the Navy, a Harvard team led by Navy Lieutenant Grace Hopper ran a series of tests on it beginning in July of 1947. The Harvard Mark II logbook from September 9, 1947, reveals how a bug was found during this testing. The log states, September 9th, 10 o'clock. Relays 6 and 2 in 033 failed special speed test. 1 meter relay failed special speed test. Relays changed. 11 o'clock. Started cosine tape. Sign check. 1525. Started multi-adder test. 1545. Relay number 70, panel F. Moth in relay. First actual case of bug being found. Next to that note, a desiccated moth is taped to the page. Now, some accounts will say that this shows that Grace Hopper invented the term computer bug, but the term bug and the concept of debugging were already in widespread use. The funny part about this is that an actual physical insect caused a problem with their computer that had to be debugged. Lieutenant Hopper was a Yale-educated mathematician who had left a professorship at Vassar College to join the Navy during World War II. She would remain in the Navy for over 42 years, finally retiring in 1986 as a Rear Admiral, one of just a handful of female flag officers. During her career, she was a pioneer computer scientist, popularizing the concept of machine-independent programming languages, developing low-level compilers, and inventing a number of programming languages, including COBOL, which is still in use.
Finally, Sunday is September 10th. In May of 1801, a young man named Jason Fairbanks was accused of killing his girlfriend, Eliza Fales. He went to her house covered in blood, with knife wounds to his chest, stomach, and throat. He said that Eliza had killed herself and that he had tried to do the same. The coroner's report, however, didn't sound very much like a suicide. Her throat was cut into the windpipe and nearly to the back part of it. She had a wound made with a small knife by a stab in her back between her shoulder blades, beside the backbone and not far below the neck. One stab in her side, 6 deep wounds in her left arm, some of which severed the tendons, 2 slight wounds in her right arm, and a deep one in her left thumb, which severed the ball from the bone. Jason was tried and swiftly convicted of murder, and while he was awaiting execution, his brother and other relatives broke him out of jail, and together they made a run for the Canadian border. Before boarding a boat that would have taken them across Lake Champlain to St. John's, they took a breakfast break. With freedom in sight, they were recognized. Jason was detained, shipped back to Boston, and then on September 10th, he was taken back to Dedham. He was escorted by 2 companies of cavalry, a detachment of volunteer infantry, and at the border of Boston and Roxbury, was transferred between the Suffolk and Norfolk County sheriffs. When he was hanged, about 10,000 people turned out to watch. It was one of the largest crowds that ever gathered in Dedham. Fairbanks was hanged on Dedham Common and buried in the First Parish Cemetery. Check out our 10th episode for the full story.
A box of pictures from the city archives shows 2 well-dressed men in derby hats. In each photo, they pose with a cut granite stone, sometimes touching it with their hands or a staff, and sometimes leaning against it and staring off into the middle distance. In some, they're perched atop snowbanks or down in ditches. In others, they're standing among railroad tracks, looking disapprovingly at a stone that's all but buried out of sight under the railroad grade. The year is 1896, and the men are a committee appointed by the Boston City Council. The stones they're posing with are Boston's boundary stones, which are required by state law, which says that towns shall erect permanent stone monuments at every angle of their respective boundary lines, well set in the ground, at least 4 feet high from its surface, and have the initial letters of the respective names of such towns legibly cut thereon. These men are carrying out the ancient tradition of perambulating the bounds, in which the selectmen or city council choose a group to walk the town lines, locating and marking each boundary stone. That tradition can be traced back at least as far as 1651 in New England, when Massachusetts Bay Colony adopted an act respecting bounds of town lands. For as much as the bounds of towns and of the lands of particular persons are carefully to be maintained, and not without great danger to be removed by any, which notwithstanding by deficiency and decay of marks may at unawares be done, whereby great jealousies of persons, troubles in towns, and encumbrances in courts do often arise, which by due care and means might be prevented. It is therefore ordered by this court and by the authority thereof, that every town shall set out their bounds within 12 months after their bounds are granted, and that when their grounds are once set out, once in 3 years, 3 or more persons of a town, appointed by the selectmen, shall appoint with the adjacent towns to go the bounds betwixt their said towns and renew their marks, which marks shall be a great heap of stones, or a trench of 6 feet long, and 2 feet broad, the most ancient town to give notice of the time and place of the meeting for this perambulation, which time shall be in the first or second month, upon pain of £5 for every town that shall neglect the same.
Over time, that standard would evolve to require perambulation every 5 years, and boundary stones instead of trenches or heaps of stones. A system of meets and bounds similar to modern surveying was also used, so a town boundary would extend 400 feet northwest from Mr. Allen's stone wall to a large oak tree, then turn due north for 250 feet to a brook. However, the older system of perambulation was kept to imbue town borders and property lines with a sense of ritual. Yale historian Allegra de Bonaventura notes, "New Englanders utilized the old performance to support and inform what became a new and, by contemporary standards, modern and quantitative property regime." That first year, town records for Boston note, "24th of the 9th month, 1651. Mr. Davis, Peter Oliver, Edward Devotion, and Henry Stevens are chosen to go the bounds of the town betwixt Cambridge, Braintree, Dedham, and that way." Bonaventura notes the importance of creating formal boundaries of towns and farms in the minds of early English colonists. Ordinary New Englanders compelled this legal and symbolic transformation from wilderness to property, not simply by writing it into statutes or deeds, pleading it before magistrates at court, or even in idle musings over a rum or a neighbor's fence. They enacted the change, scoring it deeply into trees and stumps, heaving it onto mounds of native stones, and, of course, by stamping out its lines with the soles of their feet. The practice of perambulation spread to New Hampshire and Connecticut, but as far as we can tell, no other state or colony in North America adopted the practice. And 1651 may have marked the first official perambulation in Boston, but the tradition has much older roots in Old England. Dating back to the late Middle Ages, churches maintained a tradition called beating the bounds, where parties from each church would walk the perimeter of their parish. The term beating the bounds likely comes from the practice of whacking the cornerstones or posts with a branch to verify that it would stand for another year. However, some accounts say that young boys were whipped or beaten at each corner mark. This would impress the location into their memories, and the memory of parish bounds would last as long as possible. Even as far back as the 10th century, the laws of Anglo-Saxon King Æthelstan mention the practice, which is thought to have originated with a Roman festival called Terminalia, celebrated in February in honor of the god of landmarks.
Back when Boston was a tiny village on the Shawmut Peninsula, perambulating the bounds was probably pretty easy. But as the town grew over the years, the job got bigger. Can you name all the towns that Boston shares a land boundary with today? Today the bordering towns are Winthrop, Revere, Everett, Somerville, Brookline, Milton, Dedham, and Newton. Back in 1896, Boston had a boundary with the independent town of Hyde Park, which wasn't annexed until 1912. And of course that doesn't count towns like Quincy or Watertown that border us only by water. Despite the growing size of the town and the increasing amount of walking involved, perambulating the bounds seems to have turned into a fairly festive affair over the years. In 1765, the Selectmen of Boston resolved, "Whereas this year is the time appointed by law for perambulating the bounds betwixt town and town, it was therefore agreed upon and ordered by the Selectmen that Tuesday the 15th of this instant October be the time for running the line and renewing the bound marks." The committee included Samuel Sewell and John Hancock. They were both selectmen of Boston, and both men of considerable means. They could have easily chosen somebody else to walk the line, but they didn't. The fact that the committee met with their counterparts from Roxbury at 10 in the morning in a tavern on Boston Neck may have had something to do with it. I get the distinct impression that the committee members passed a bottle during the quinquennial perambulation for many generations. If so, they were carrying on a tradition that dates back to the times of King Henry VIII, when Richard Banks complained in his 1530 Epistles and Gospels that beating the bounds had turned into one giant party, saying, These solemn and accustomable processions and supplications be now grown into a rightful and detestable abuse. Some accounts even say that the practice of repainting the boundary stones with red paint gave rise to the phrase painting the town red due to the heavy drinking and revelry involved. But we can't find a reliable source for that.
Perambulating the bounds makes less sense in an era with modern surveying techniques, aerial photography, GPS, and drones. However, the law requiring perambulation of the bounds is still on the books. In 2017, the law reads, "The boundary markers of every town shall be located, the marks thereon renewed, and the year located marked upon the face thereof which bears the letter of the town locating its boundary, once every 5 years, by at least two of the selectmen of the town, or by every two substitutes designated by them in writing. The marking shall be made with a paint or other suitable marking material. The proceedings shall be recorded with the town clerk and the board of selectmen of the town in writing, signed under penalty of perjury, setting forth which boundary marks were located and those which were not located. A copy of such records shall also be sent by registered letter to the town clerk and the board selectmen of any contiguous town. A selectman who refuses or neglects to perform any duty required of him by the two preceding sections shall forfeit $20. It was easy to find information on the earliest perambulations, but modern history was a lot harder to figure out. It seems like a lot of city councilors in recent years have been willing to run the risk of that $20 fine. With a little help from the city archives, we found the 1976 order to walk the bounds. That two members of the city council, the city clerk, and the division engineer of the engineering division of the public works department, or their duly appointed substitutes, be, and hereby are, appointed on behalf of the city council to perambulate the boundary lines and to examine the bound marks between Boston and the adjacent cities and towns of Revere, Everett, Somerville, Newton, Brookline, Dedham, Milton, and Winthrop. To report descriptions of the same and to cause bound marks to be erected or removed wherever necessary, the expense incurred under authority of this order, if any, to be charged to the City Council appropriation for transportation of persons.
That wasn't the last perambulation, though. 5 years later, Boston perambulated its bounds for the last time. In December of 1981, the City Council formed a committee of two councilors, the city clerk, and two city engineers. Over the course of two winter days, they met with representatives of the surrounding towns and formally walked the town lines for what would prove to be the very last time. Not only was it the last perambulation of the bounds, they actually recorded some interesting findings in their official report to the city council. Things got off to a rocky start with the Somerville boundary. Not only were many of the bounds missing or inadequate, the Somerville committee didn't bother to show up. Boston, Somerville. We failed to make contact with the Somerville committee, but viewed boundary markers along Caldwell Street, Parker Street, and Crescent Street. None of these meet statutory standards as to the size or markings. We also made an effort to locate the key marker in the Boston and Main Railroad yard, but it was covered with snow and ice. We recommend a joint effort with Somerville to reestablish this boundary with satisfactory markers. Things began to look up after that when they moved on to Cambridge. There had been a 32-year gap since the last perambulation, and the committee pointed out a fact that I was never aware of. Although we were advised that Boston has not met with Cambridge since 1949, there is in fact a land boundary between the two cities, in the Federal Liquor Complex by the viaduct near the Gilmore Bridge, caused by an ancient shift in the course of the Charles River. We viewed this entire area. The Boston territory is essentially occupied at present by the Federal GSA Motor Pool. The boundary is unmarked. If it were to be properly marked, at least three granite markers should be installed after survey. Since there is no tax yield to Boston, and the utility companies have raised objections to servicing the area in its present configuration, we recommend transferring it to Cambridge and restoring the midpoint of the Charles as the boundary. The topography around Gilmore Bridge has changed a lot thanks to the Big Dig, but it looks like there is still a land boundary between Cambridge and Boston there, and possibly in the nearby North Point Park. The boundary definitely wasn't shifted to the midpoint of the Charles.
The irregular boundary with Everett is even more notable. We were met in front of the Boston Edison plant by Alderman Davis and Engineer Sullivan. We viewed the boundary line, which passes through the parking lot, divides a house lot, cuts off a piece of an Everett Park, and loops around Broadway at Chemical Lane. This line is improperly marked, there being no indicators in the parking lot, an inadequate one at Dexter Street, and none anywhere else. The committee believes this boundary must be attended to. This is where it gets good. The committee believes this boundary must be attended to. If it is to remain as is, we recommend a resurvey and installation of one or several flat rosettes in the parking lot, proper granite markers at Dexter Street and Chemical Lane, and one more where the boundary meets the Mystic River. The committee, however, believes the boundary should be adjusted. It is a throwback to colonial days and appears to result from an ancient ferry whose proprietors arranged to add a piece of the Everett Shore to Boston in order to have both termini in the same town. The present configuration forces Boston to cross the Malden Bridge and plow and clear nearly half a mile of what everyone believes is an Everett City street. The tax yield to Boston is not substantial and is apparently balanced by the cost of the services we provide. We recommend a petition to the General Court ceding this salient to Everett, along with half the responsibility for the Malden Bridge. A proposed form of petition is attached to this report. Looking at a modern map, there's a tiny island of Boston on the Everett side of the Mystic River, which is apparently a throwback to a colonial ferry. Perhaps another story for another time, but we haven't turned that land back over to Everett, and we're still plowing it every winter. So it's been 26 years since we stopped perambulating the bounds of Boston, but it's not too late to bring it back. Council President Wu, if you're listening, we are more than happy to serve as your committee for the 2017 perambulation of the bounds. You buy the drinks, and we'll even do it pro bono.
Big thanks this week to Marta Crilly, Research and Outreach Archivist for the City of Boston. Marta was very quickly able to determine that the last perambulation took place in 1981, and she dug up the 1981 City Council report for us. Thanks also to Adam Gaffin of the Boston news site Universal Hub. His 2012 article on perambulating the bounds was the first time we'd heard about the practice. To learn more about perambulating the bounds, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/044. We'll link to that first article from the Universal Hub and to the City Council report Marta found for us. We'll have photos of some of Boston's surviving boundary stones, including my favorite, deep in the woods along the Neponset River, where four towns come together at a single stone. We'll also link to those photos from the 1896 perambulation, the text of the 1651 Act Respecting Bounds of Town Lands, and Allegra de Bonaventura's paper on the importance of perambulation in early New England. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries.
If you want to get in touch, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We are Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. And if you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show about Boston's skin book.